Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, an independent New Orleans bookstore. Additional support comes from the University of Louisiana Lafayette Press and the Helles Foundation. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, your weekly look at the Louisiana literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. Today is a very special day as we're welcoming WRKF listeners in the Baton Rouge area, as well as our WWNO listeners in New Orleans. This week, I'll be talking with Alexandria Marzano-Lesnovich, author of The Fact of a Body, A Murder, A Memoir, and journalist-turned-novelist Omar El Akkad, author of American War. Alexandria Marzano-Lesnovich first came to New Orleans as a young law student, doing anti-death penalty work. Her beliefs would be tested when she began to work on the case of Ricky Langley, tried three times for the 1992 murder in Iowa, Louisiana, of young Jeremy Guillory, whose body he hid away in a closet. Alexandria's brilliant new book, The Fact of a Body, A Murder and a Memoir, takes that case and looks at it in depth, all the while confronting the troubling history in her own family. She teaches writing at Grub Street in Boston and is a professor in the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard. Alexandria, welcome to The Reading Life.
Thank you so much for having me. This is quite a thrill.
Well, this is just an amazing book. I couldn't wait to put it down. I couldn't wait to see what you do next. And you begin with, as you say in the title, The Fact of a Body, the fact that starts everything. And your investigation ripples outward from that. And you were very young when this happened. You were still a law student.
I was just 25 when I first heard of this murder. And for me, what happened was that I had a strong emotional response that I didn't fully understand. And that feeling of there being something in there, something inside me that was colliding that I didn't fully understand yet and couldn't articulate, was what stayed with me for years to come and what ultimately led me to start to reinvestigate the case and ultimately write about it.
So what was the process for writing this book? When did you actually start writing it, and when did you know you'd write it?
That's a fantastic question, and it's one that is so hard to answer because, like a lot of writers, I think, I had this obsession or this inkling, this pursuit that, I didn't fully understand. And so it began with me just kind of writing about things that had happened in my own life. But I noticed that I kept thinking about the story of this murder, even though at the time I knew very little about it. I hadn't yet gotten all the files. Then I got the first 8,000 pages of court records, and I should say that ultimately I would find about 30,000 pages in rural Louisiana. But I got the first 8,000, not because I thought I would write about it, but because I really wanted to lay this story to rest inside me. I thought that if I just faced this murder I had heard about when I was 25, and I kind of looked at these files, that I might stop thinking about it. I think the unknown often obsesses us more than the known. So I wanted to lay it to rest. And that just isn't what happened. I instead felt myself more and more drawn into the story. And the whole time I was kind of writing my way around it, writing to try to make sense of what I was reading. But it wasn't until sometime later that I really accepted that I was writing a book.
Ah, you know you're deep into it when you know you're writing a book. One of the things that's so interesting that you bring home over and over again is how much law is about the body. You bring that home in so many ways. The law is meant to prohibit events such as abuse or murder, but then when the law is broken, it's there to exact retribution. And ultimately, it becomes so personal.
That's a beautiful way to put it. One of the things that made me realize I had to write about the case was that when I got the legal records, I thought that I would be able to leave behind this personal reaction it was having in me, this personal thing it was calling forth. I really thought of the law as a place where pure ideals came together, where reason was privileged. If I was going to be true to the legal ideals, I would be able to shed the emotional pull it had on me, the emotional pull that I felt in my body. And yet when I got the records, one of the big things I noticed was that it seemed like everyone was actually interpreting the murder through their own lives. Everybody actually carried memories with them and interpreted it through their bodies. And so writing the book and giving the reader my own memories became this mission to try to capture this process where hopefully people read the book, read my own memories, and they see the humanity story kind of refracted through those memories, the same way that other people who came to the case saw it through the lens of their own lives. And so what I wanted to capture was how much the law is a space of things that we carry in our body, even though I would say that we've built ourselves a system that pretends that's not the case, that pretends this pure realm of reason.
Now, law for you has always been a family affair. You're the daughter of two lawyers. I loved it when you said, I was raised in the law the way other children were raised in religion.
It was. It was the thing we talked about over the dinner table. You know, we talked about the Constitution a lot. And I grew up with this really beautiful idea of the law as the space where we made our philosophical commitments plain as a society, the space where we said what the best version of ourselves that we wanted to be was. And I think that's one of the reasons that the death penalty was so jarring for me to learn about when I was a child, because here I loved what the law was trying to do. I still think the common law is just sort of a beautiful structure that our legal system is based on. The system of precedent is this beautiful structure. And yet it was intentionally taking someone's life. And that was really challenging for me to think about.
Do you still practice, or have you decided to completely devote yourself to writing?
I don't practice law. I realized eventually that the things I was most interested in were the things that weren't making it into the official legal narrative. So in this case, for example, you know, the book itself is so complicated. It takes us through so many wild stories. And then, as I sort of say at the end, the actual trial was very simple. And so much of, I think, how we really understand this crime of people actually didn't make it into the legal record, actually didn't make it into the judgment of Ricky Langley. And I kind of wanted to push back against that, because when I talked to people who had been involved in legal cases, it seemed like they were haunted by things that were left out, and that our public idea of the trial as an assessment or judgment of this person maybe wasn't accounting for all the human parts of us that make this judgment.
Well, and you recount how one of the trials was so difficult and so strange because the judge who was hearing it kept leaving the room.
Absolutely. I would say I'm still trying to figure out what exactly was happening with him. I think in some ways the emotions of it were overwhelming him. We don't have space to really talk about this question in the law, but I think when you talk to individual people involved in the law, the emotional impacts of the cases they're involved in are this very real factor that we just don't have an accounting of or even assessment of or know how widespread it is or how much it affects these cases.
Now, you confront so many tough truths in this book, and so much of it is personal in the memoir part of it. You talk about your abuse by your grandfather, the lack of support you received from your family, seeing your grandfather abuse your sister as well, and coming out and moving on into the life you have now as a writer and a professor. And it is such a candid reckoning. It's so rare to have somebody be so brutally honest about a life that contains so many difficulties. I mean, it's such a brave book. That's what I'm trying to say. It's just a brave book.
Thank you. You know, that took a lot of drafts because I think, like everyone else, my subconscious was kind of deeply resistant to opening up in this public way. It was initially very hard to get used to. A couple of things helped me. Reading helped me a lot. There were many memoirs, but as I read them, I thought, oh gosh, if this person can be so brave and so honest, how dare I avoid what I'm trying to say? Why can't I just go ahead and say it? A big one for me was a book by Kelly Groom called I Wore the Ocean in the Shape of a Girl. And I vividly remember reading that, you know, sitting on a couch somewhere when I was avoiding my desk and I was sort of trying not to write and getting to a scene in that book that was just so vivid and so honest and ripped something open inside me the way I think the best books do, that I thought, oh, I have to face this. I have to write this. I must be this brave. And I went to my desk that moment and started to write. So that helped me a lot. And also teaching helped me a lot, because I think a lot of what keeps us silent or what keeps us feeling self-conscious is the sense that we must be alone in having these things in our lives. And yet when you teach memoir, you very quickly realize that you're not alone, that actually everyone has these unsayable, unnameable things in their past, and many people are haunted by them. And I began to think that if I had the ability to write down what had happened, then I sort of owed it to others to do so. My dearest hope is that maybe it will open that up for somebody else. Maybe it will help give them language for something that they went through in the past.
Well, sometimes I think books give us great courage, and that makes us able to pay it forward in a way, just like you're doing with your students.
I absolutely think books give us courage. Absolutely. My favorite books are the ones that open something inside me that I didn't even know was there.
Now, the fact of a body is a great reckoning in the way that all the best memoirs are. And you've had some time now waiting for publication to stand back from it a bit. I'm curious to know what you hope this book will do out in the world when you let it go to find its own life.
I really hope it makes a space for complexity. A lot of what the book is saying, a lot of what the book is looking at, is taking these simple stories that were made about the past, one that was made in my family, one that was made in the legal system about Ricky's case, and saying, oh, no, it wasn't that simple. It was more complicated. And, you know, we do a disservice to the past. We do a disservice to Jeremy Guillory, who was murdered by Ricky Langley. We do a disservice to the people in Ricky Langley's life. We do the disservice to the child I was, and even to my grandfather, when we make the story of the past really neat and really simple, and we pretend it was cleaner than it was. What I really hope is that the book makes room for complexity. I say in the book that one of the hardest but most necessary things for me to discover or to realize was that my grandfather abused me, and he was also my grandfather. Yes. And he was my grandfather, and he abused me. So I have to hold the good and the bad together. And I think that's honest.
And I'm curious to know, it seems like Louisiana has been a special source of inspiration for you for writing. I mean, you have this wonderful essay about the Angola prison rodeo in this new anthology Waveform. So I know you've been back several times.
I have. I just love it madly. I just love the whole state. I love traveling throughout it. I think New Orleans is a place that you either love in your bones or you don't quite understand. And for me, from the very first moment I was there, it just felt like coming home, which is strange because it's so different than the world I was from. But I just love it madly.
And you've certainly captured so much of real Louisiana life, and so much of it is so sad in this book. It's an amazing, amazing achievement. There's nothing else like it. It's like you've written a new kind of book. I felt totally caught up in this world, as disturbing as parts of it were. But I kept wanting to see what you thought about what you were experiencing. And I love books about people's interior lives. You know what I mean? There's such a pleasure to enter into. And you invite people in for such close communication. It's a real gift, I think, to be able to do that.
Thank you. As a reader, my dearest love is when the world falls away and when I tumble into the world of a book. I really love that feeling of being spellbound, of being in what some people call the fictive dream, even if in this case it's a non-fictive dream.
Right.
And that was what I really wanted to create as an experience for the reader. So it means a great deal to me to hear that that happened for you. Thank you.
Well done. We've been talking with Alexandria Marzano-Lesnovich, author of The Fact of a Body, A Murder and a Memoir. You can meet her Tuesday, May 23rd, when she reads at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Alexandria, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me. It was a pleasure.
Omar El Akkad is a journalist, born in Egypt, raised in Qatar, now living in Portland, Oregon. He's covered the war in Afghanistan, military trials at Gitmo, the Arab Spring in Egypt, and the Black Lives Matter movement in Ferguson, Missouri. Today, we're talking about his first novel, The Amazing and Very Moving American War. Omar El Akkad, welcome to The Reading Life.
Thanks for having me.
What a book this is. I couldn't stop reading it. It's just such a page-turner. It envisions a civil war that breaks out in 2074, and the first setting of your novel is Louisiana, and your protagonist, Sarat Chestnut, is a young girl from our state. Would you talk a bit about creating this war and choosing this setting?
I started writing the book in the summer of 2014. And I knew the arc of the story. I knew generally what was going to happen. But what I didn't know was where the Chestnuts would live. And then one day I was on assignment in southern Louisiana doing a story about land loss, the extent to which southern Louisiana is essentially running out of land due to rising sea levels and so on and so forth. And as soon as I got down there, I knew that this is where the story needed to take place. I knew that this is where my protagonists lived. This is where they called home, in large part because the land was disappearing. So in the novel, southern Louisiana is about 100 miles north of where southern Louisiana currently is because of rising sea levels. But it was one of those situations where I landed in a place and it just struck me how gorgeous and fragile it was. And from there, I knew that that was where the story had to be set.
And you write so beautifully about the landscape, the last shredded remnants of lower Louisiana. And there used to be the loveliest city in all America on what's now a shoreline. That's very moving to all of us who live here, of course. But you also write of the optimistic notion that with enough concrete and dirt and pride and money, the Lowcountry could be saved. So I thought that was a very powerful statement on what we're facing in the years ahead.
One of the things that was really interesting to me when I got down to Louisiana is the extent to which the government and to which the people who are trying to save this part of the world have to make these trade-offs. You know, you go to these sort of shredded peninsulas of land at the southernmost coast, and you see these places where they've built dams or they've built levees, but they don't build them at the very southern tip of the land. They build them higher up, and that there's sort of an unspoken message there that, you know, everything south of here probably can't be saved in the long run. And I found that to be a very sort of stunning thing for anyone to have to deal with, the idea that, you know, the place that's solid ground right now might not be that way in a few decades' time. That was really affecting to me.
One of the things that motivated you to write this novel was the idea that American war doesn't often take place on American land. And you wanted to create that kind of landscape. I wonder if you'd talk a little bit about creating that landscape of war, you know, how you drew on things that you have actually seen in your reporting and turning all those observational skills from journalism to fiction.
Yeah, a lot of the book is composed of outright theft. I was a journalist for 10 years, and a lot of the things I saw and experienced are in the book. The central trick of the book, if there is one, is to take all of these wars that have defined the world in my lifetime, and these are wars in which U.S. involvement has either been indirect or from a great distance, and recast them as elements of something very close to home, something from which it was difficult to look away, in this case, a second American Civil War. So a lot of the things I saw when I was covering the NATO invasion of Afghanistan, for example, make their way into this book. There's an entire chapter at a place called Sugarloaf Detention Camp, which is pretty obviously based on Guantanamo Bay. So a lot of the book is that sort of turnabout, taking these wars that have happened very far away from here and recast them as something very close.
And how did you choose the time frame for this book?
I never set out to write a book about the future. There was never, you know, any intent on my part to write a sci-fi book or a speculative fiction or anything like that. Really, two reasons. I needed time for the world that I was building to marinate. So in the book, sea level rise has essentially wiped out the coast of the U.S. Florida is gone entirely. And I needed time for even that sort of implausible level of sea level rise to take place. The other reason is because in the book, there's a new empire. It's all the Middle Eastern and North African states have formed essentially a new United States, an empire made up of many different states. And basically, I just needed some time for these things to take place. And it seemed to me that it would be even more science fiction-y to set this book in 2020 as opposed to 2075.
Now, Surratt is one of the most remarkable characters I've ever encountered. I mean, I really can't quit thinking about her. And I'm curious if you talk a little bit about her creation, how she came to you and what it was like to take this journey with her.
Yeah, I mean, this is one of those cop-outs that authors use all the time, but she really came to me fully formed. You know, everything else in the book got rewritten. Every other character got rewritten over and over again. But the six-year-old girl who shows up at the beginning of the story at the porch of her parents' house on the banks of the Mississippi Sea, she arrived fully formed. And I knew what arc she was going to take from the beginning of the story. To me, it's her story above all else. Above everything else I tried to do with the book, it's effectively her story. It belongs to her. And she, to me, sort of is defined by this very stubborn, defiant curiosity. She wants to know everything she can. And the central tragedy of the book is how that curiosity is sort of turned against her, both by the war itself and what happens to her during the war, and also the sort of people who would manipulate her for their own ends. But it really is, it's her story more than anything else.
So tell us a little bit about what happens to her in the course of the war.
When the story begins, she's a six-year-old girl living with her parents by the banks of the Mississippi Sea. the southernmost end of the Mississippi River is now effectively a sea. And what happens is that Louisiana in the book is not part of the southern states that secede from the Union, you know, that sort of sparked this second Civil War. Nonetheless, the fighting in East Texas, Texas is one of the states that secedes, the fighting in Texas sort of works its way close to their home and forces them from their home. So the Chestnuts have to go to a refugee camp in the heart of the southern secessionist state. And she grows up in this refugee camp, effectively. And the book sort of follows what happens to her as the war sort of invades her life and how it makes her an entirely different person. And by the end of the book, how it effectively radicalizes her and turns her into a weapon.
One of the things you do so wonderfully in this book is you give us this fully drawn woman. I mean, even though she's a twin, she is uniquely herself. And you give us even the life of her body. I mean, she's tall and she's strong, and then she is completely broken and changed by war.
Yeah, she, at a certain point in the book, she moved away from me. She became herself and all of the things that I had sort of envisioned for her, because I come from a journalism background, so I'm the sort of writer who does months of research and plots out everything and sort of draws up a battle plan before every scene. And at a certain point, that sort of faded away. That became irrelevant because she had sort of taken over, which again sounds like one of those things you get to say as an author that really doesn't mean much, but really she sort of became herself. And one of the really important things to me was that I did not create a fundamentally good person, that I created someone who was, by the end of the book, not someone you were expected to sympathize with or apologize for or be on their side. All I wanted was for you to understand how they got to be the way they are. And that, for me, was the sort of driving principle for everything I described about Surratt. I didn't want you to like her or sympathize with her. I just wanted you to understand.
Well, and then what happens is that you can't forget her. I mean, so that's the best kind of experience for a reader. I'm curious, this is your first published novel, but you've said you have three others in a drawer somewhere, and it was different for you because you felt it was necessary.
Yeah, so this is the fourth one I've written, the first one that's ever left the hard drive. I've never tried to publish the other three, and with good reason. They're not particularly good. But I think there's really only two reasons to write fiction, is sort of vanity or necessity. You know, that idea, that do you want to be heard or do you want to say something? I'm a terrible judge of my own writing. I can never tell if it's any good or not, and the same is true with this book. But at the very least, when I was done writing this, I felt that it was somewhat necessary, that it said something I needed to say. And that was the only sort of driving reason for trying to get it published. When I was writing it, I had no agent, I had no publisher, and I had no expectation that it would ever see the light of day. But at least it felt somewhat necessary, and that was really the only reason that I tried to get it out into the world.
Well, it felt necessary to me when I was reading it. I carried it around everywhere with me, so. Now, one of the things you do so well, especially considering that you are a journalist and you are concerned with facts, but you marry these recognizable political realities, our profligate use of fossil fuels, our disregard for climate change, with those eternal human failings, those faults like our desire for vengeance, our desire for ruination. That's an extraordinary line to walk as a fiction writer when you have a message to give.
Yeah, I started my journalism career in Canada. I'm working for the Canadian National Paper, and about 3 days after I was hired on full-time, I must have been about 23 at the time, Canada had its largest terrorism arrest in the country's history. And so I spent the next year of my life covering the story, in part because, you know, I was one of the few brown people in that newspaper. I was one of the few people who spoke Arabic or knew anything about Islam. And so I covered these people who had been radicalized, effectively. And so by the end of that year and a half, I had gotten this very detailed education in how people become radicalized, what the preconditions need to be, how you sort of slowly work them into a place where they can become evil. And all of these things stuck with me because they required all of these fundamentally human things. You saw these people who slowly became damaged and slowly became very susceptible to radicalization. And then 10 years later, all of that has stuck with me to the point that I needed to get it out in some form of writing, and then fiction seemed to be the best way to do that.
Well, one of the things I do love about this book is that even in this desperate future, books are important, letters are important, writing is important. That's one of the best parts of this to me, you know. It made me feel a little hopeful about things. So what's next for you? Another novel? Back to journalism? What do you see?
I'm working on another piece of fiction. I have no idea if it's any good or even remotely publishable, but it's what's consuming my life these days. And I never know with these things until I'm done with them how they're going to turn out, but that's what I'm hoping to do.
Well, that is indeed good news. We've been talking with journalist and novelist Omar El Akkad, whose brilliant new novel is American War. You can meet him Wednesday, May 17th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Omar, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Christopher Pena discusses in Science the strange case of Dr. Etienne Deschamps, murder in the French Quarter, Tuesday, May 16th at 6:30 at the Hubble Library. Pena also appears Saturday, May 20th at 1:30 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie as guest speaker for the May meeting of Sisters in Crime New Orleans. Today's guest, Omar El Akkad, discusses in Science American War, Wednesday, May 17th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. James Nolan discusses Ensign's Flight Risk, Memoirs of a New Orleans Bad Boy, Thursday, May 18th at 6 at Maple Street Bookshop. Deborah Burst discusses Spirits of the Bayou, Sanctuaries, Cemeteries, and Hauntings, Saturday, May 20th at 10 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. The Octavia Books Book Club discusses My Brilliant Friend by Elena Ferrante, Saturday, May 20th at 10:30 at Octavia Books. Allie Bergeres and her faithful companion Sesame the Opossum talk about their new book, Opossums Don't Live in Houses, Saturday, May 20th at 2 at the French Library, 3811 Magazine Street. Please RSVP to The Grownups at thefrenchlibrary.com. The Adult Book Club discusses All Our Wrong Todays by Ilan Mastai, Saturday, May 20th at 2 at the East New Orleans Regional Library. New members are welcome. Kathy Schrenk reads from Ensign's A Dog Steals Home, Sunday, May 21st from 11 to noon at the Kids' Tent at Bayou Boogaloo on the banks of Bayou St. John. National Readathon Day is Sunday, May 21st. Faulkner House Books will be celebrating with a reading by James Nolan, author of Flight Risk, Memoirs of a New Orleans Bad Boy, Brenda McLean, author of One Good Mama Bone, Johnny Bernard, author of A Good Girl, and Sanam Osterhal, author of The Dark Shall Do What the Light Cannot. That's from 2:30 to 5. If you'd like to attend, please RSVP at Faulkhouse, faulkhouse.org. Poet and artist Thaddeus Kantai reads from his work and presents a newly published volume of his drawings, followed by an open mic, Sunday, May 21st at 3 at the Maple Leaf Bar. Today's guest, Alexandria Marzano-Lesnovich, discusses and signs The Fact of a Body, a Murder, a Memoir, Tuesday, May 23rd at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Nancy Sharon Collins hosts a reading of Letters from Lafcadi O'Hearn by actors Richard Mayer and Ashton Eckridge, Tuesday, May 23rd at 6 at Crescent City Books. And New Orleans book lovers got some sad news last week when Gladden Scott, owner of Maple Street Bookshop, announced that the store will be closing June 17th after more than 50 years in business. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, Our Lady of Holy Cross College, the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press, and the Hellas Foundation. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life are by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by Jenny Lawson and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at WWNO.org. And you can email us at thereadinglife@WWNO.org. Thanks for listening and keep reading.